True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
The girls went into the store, and when they came out, they had a flat tire. And these two guys on the parking lot offered to help them, and they didn't have a spare tire, so said, well, we'll take you home. Well, instead, they took them for a ride and terrorized them all the way out to Fremont Canyon. And, you know, and Becky was, you know, very kind and would go with anybody, and she just didn't want, she, you know, begged them not to hurt her sister.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Happy New Year, everybody.
Just before 9 p.m. on September 24th, 1973, 18-year-old Becky Thompson was leaving to buy groceries, and she asked her 11-year-old half-sister, Amy Burridge, if she wanted to tag along. The two traveled in Becky's Ford station wagon to the Thriftway store on 12th and Melrose Streets in Casper, Wyoming. When Becky and Amy came out of the store, one of the car's tires was flat. Unbeknownst to the sisters, the two men who had slashed the tire, Jerry Jenkins and Ronald Kennedy, were the same guys who pulled into the parking spot next to them at that moment, and the men offered to help. Becky and Amy had been set up for an abduction. That night was the night when Becky's worst nightmare came true on the Fremont Canyon Bridge. The cold-heartedness and cruelty of Jenkins and Kennedy was more than anyone in the community could comprehend, and it would haunt Becky until the day that she died. So this is a truly haunting case for our New Year's episode. One of the most disturbing cases for me, I guess for personal reasons. It's just a really upsetting case for me. It's been hard for me to research it.
This was a tough case.
It really was. So what kind of a beer are we going to have to drink to get us through this?
We're going to have a sour ale.
Well, thanks, Dick. You were thinking of me, weren't you?
I was. This is a sour called Le Serpent Cerise by Snake River Brewing Company in Jackson, Wyoming. So, as we've said, it's a sour. So it's a hazy reddish amber-colored beer with a big, fat, long-lasting white head. Nice-looking beer. And it's got what you'd want. Sour cherry, oak, some vanilla, and there's a hint of some currant.
Sounds delicious.
It is. It's a very tart, medium dry, nice beer. Good one.
Yeah. Let's scooch on down to the quiet end and talk about today's episode of True Crime Brewery, Bridge of Sorrow.
Okay. Ready?
I am.
So September 24th, 1973, Shara Jenkins was only a year old. But when her daddy, Jerry Jenkins, got up in the morning, she would always climb out of her bed to find him. At 7 o'clock, Jerry was getting ready to go to work at the gas station, where he'd been employed for a few weeks. Jerry's had a tough time holding jobs.
Yeah, you could say that, yes.
So he's working there, allegedly. And Shara toddled into her parents' bedroom, hugged one of her father's legs. Her mother, Darcy, was up also. Now, Darcy is only 18, so she's barely out of childhood herself.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue she's really not.
You certainly could.
She's very young.
And it was the day that Shara's baby sister, who had been born only a month before, was coming home from the hospital. She had been hospitalized for a brain infection, encephalitis or meningitis or something. And she was finally well enough to return home or to go home.
Right, and Jerry really just didn't give a shit, let's be honest.
No, I mean, we're not going to be showing too much sympathy for either of these two guys. They're just two total scumbags.
Total scumbags, you're right.
So while Shara and Jerry waited for Darcy to pour some cereal, they ate cookies and candy. Jerry's gray station wagon had a flat, and he needed to get to work, so he borrowed Darcy's white Impala. While they were eating breakfast, Jerry mentioned that he was having trouble at work. He just wasn't happy there, he told Darcy. Now, Darcy'd been with Jerry long enough to know what that meant. He was going to quit, that is, if he hadn't already been fired. Jerry would always promise to find a job and stick with it, but he never kept a job very long. He hated to be told what to do. So he's 29. He's a lazy, irresponsible who just basically drinks and smokes weed during the day. Now, he promised he'd be back by 1 to go pick up the baby at the hospital.
Yeah, so Jerry left, and Darcy spent the rest of the morning getting the apartment ready for the baby to come home. She fed little Shara some lunch, but 1 p.m. came and went, and no Jerry, and no call from Jerry. At 2 p.m., she called the gas station where he worked. And of course, Jerry never came to work that day, the boss told her. In fact, he hadn't been to work in several days, she learned. So poor Darcy, here she is, 18, 2 tiny little kids, and she's with this irresponsible asshole of a guy.
Yep.
And he's worse than she even knew. Of course, we'll come to find that out. Little Shara was born in June 1972, and a month later, Jerry sent a message to Darcy that he wanted to see his baby. So she was fearing that he would stalk her forever if she didn't let him see the baby. So she met with him secretly because if her parents found out, they would be livid. Then 2 weeks later, she was back together with Jerry. And 2 months after that, they went away to a small town nearby and they got married without her parents' approval. After that, they moved around a lot that first year, but they finally settled into a cheap apartment. And Darcy worked hard as a nurse's aide and as a waitress. Jerry did take jobs, but they never lasted long. Instead, he liked to stay home and watch soap operas on TV.
Now, almost 2 years since they had met, Darcy finally decided to leave Jerry for good. This episode with the newborn coming home from the hospital was apparently the final straw for her. So she planned to move to Colorado, where her parents lived. She'd leave that night, she decided, as soon as Jerry did get home, with the only working car they owned. She grew even more determined when a friend visited her and told her he'd seen Jerry and his no-good friend Ron Kennedy drinking and playing pool. Her friend ended up driving Darcy to the hospital to pick up the new baby. And back at home, she laid the baby in the bed and started packing, getting ready to get out of there.
So after school that day, Amy Burridge walked home with her best friend, Danny. Amy had always been more comfortable with boys than girls. She was a tomboy and quite outspoken. She was 11 years old. Amy would rather ride a dirt bike than play with a doll. When the other neighborhood girls were playing house and dress up, Amy was out in the sandlot with the neighborhood boys. So Danny and Amy played some football together until the sun went down that day, and then they sat on the lawn chatting. They hated to go inside. They never wanted the day to end, especially when they could be outdoors playing. Amy's older half-sister, Becky, came out of the house with her car keys a little before 9 p.m. "Mom wants me to get some stuff at the store," Becky told her. "Why don't you come along?" So Amy got up and turned to Danny and wanted him to go with her, but he wasn't allowed to. He asked his mom, and she said, "No, it's 9 p.m. on a school night. You have to come in." So Amy shrugged and waved, Becky smiled, and the two girls drove away. Jerry Jenkins had left his apartment that morning, and he'd gone straight over to Ron Kennedy's place. Kennedy didn't have a job. He lived with his wife at his mother's house, and he wanted to spend as much time away as possible to avoid any responsibilities in the home. Jenkins had skipped work for a few days by then, but this was his payday. So he wanted Kennedy to go down to the gas station where he was working, tell his boss a story about Jerry being sick, and pick up Jerry's check. So Kennedy agreed to. They played pool and drank beer, and Jenkins hid out at a local truck stop cafe while Kennedy went and lied for him. So instead of calling his wife or going home, Jenkins drove Kennedy around for the next 5 or 6 hours, looking for girls and stopping at bars. So around 9 p.m., Jenkins decided he needed to go buy some cigarettes and get something to eat.
They ended up at the Thriftway, a convenience store. Jenkins still had a little bit of his paycheck left, even though he'd only cashed it that afternoon. They'd been spending it on beer and stuff, important things.
Yeah, and he's got 2 little babies at home.
Yeah, well, he'd worry about feeding his family tomorrow.
Sure.
So he pulled in and parked at almost the same time as a white station wagon pulled in. A tall, dark-haired girl and a little girl with pigtails got out. The older girl was absolutely beautiful.
So this, of course, was Amy and her big sister, Becky.
Right. And at 9:30, Amy called her mom to tell mom we had a flat and there's two nice men are going to give us a ride home. Mom said, okay, be careful and hurry. Again, it's a school night. We've got to get her home. She's got to get to school in the morning. Mom says, I'll wait up.
Right. So her mom was Tony Case. And Tony was already in her pajamas. And although she'd been worried by her daughter's delay getting home that night, she felt better after she got the call from Amy because she knew they were safe. So after that call, they should have been home in less than 30 minutes because the store was just a mile away. Tony hadn't needed much that night, just a few things. There wasn't much to eat in the house because they'd just come home from Mexico, where they'd been visiting Tony's husband, Jack, who was the girl's stepfather. So Tony had been married 3 times, I think?
I believe so.
I think this was her 3rd husband, and the other 2 girls were from the previous 2 husbands. And her husband, Jack, was working on a drilling project down in Mexico. So they'd visited him, and they'd come home. Not much food in the house. She wants Becky to go to the store, so Becky does that. Now, the next day was a Tuesday, which would be a school day. So, of course, Amy needs to get home, and it's already past her bedtime. It was getting near her bedtime when she went to the store with her sister, but Tony had allowed it because Amy liked to go to the store with her sister, of course.
Sure.
So almost 45 minutes passed and the girls still didn't come home. So Tony began worrying again. She put on some jeans and she drove to the convenience store. And she went slowly, taking the back streets, thinking she might find them walking home. Maybe the ride that they had fell through and they had to walk home. Maybe they had stopped along the way to rest because they were carrying bags. Now, as Tony pulled into the store's parking lot, she saw Becky's car was still there. The rear passenger tire was flat, but the girls were gone. She opened the door, which was unlocked, and there were no groceries and no girls inside. The parking lot was otherwise empty, and the store was closed. So this is kind of a haunting scene for a mom to come upon.
Well, yeah.
Really scary.
She's home by herself. Girls are gone. Husband's down in Mexico.
Yeah.
And there's no reasonable explanation why the girls aren't home.
Well, no, and she had to be thinking. They said 2 guys were giving them a ride. Maybe yeah. These turned out not to be such nice guys.
I'm probably starting to get a little panicky.
Yeah, I would. So Tony drove up and down the streets between the store and their home looking for them. And this is the 1970s, so I think you didn't go right to the police back then. You drove around, you looked for people. Because things just weren't the way they are now. It was more carefree.
Oh, that's for sure.
So for almost 2 hours, she searched for her daughters. And it was a little past 12:30 in the morning when she finally did call the police. A dispatcher took her information and notified the Monday night patrol cruisers to look out for the girls. No investigator was coming on duty until 8 in the morning. And Tony didn't know enough to complain about that and get someone sooner. They just waited. Casper didn't have many police working at night, and as time passed, Tony's fear grew. Since her husband Jack was still in Mexico, she called up a friend to come and spend the night with her, and she lay in her bed that night listening for the sound of a car in the driveway or for her daughters walking through the door, just hoping that something horrible hadn't happened to them.
Well, something horrible had.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So the girls had been abducted by these 2 slime balls. And they'd been forced to lie down in the back seat of the car for 2 or 3 hours as Jenkins and Kennedy drove them around, kind of aimlessly, beating them, terrorizing them. Girls asked more than once what was going to happen. Were they going to be killed? The 2 men would laugh at them, slap them, and tell them to shut up.
So as you can imagine, Amy and Becky were terrified. As they drove, the guys told them that they were going to meet a man who would decide what to do with them. They crossed a bridge and they stopped. Pushed down on the seat, the girls couldn't see much, but in the reflected glow of headlights, they thought they saw a roof of some kind of a house or a building. So they thought, well, the man must live there, and we'll ask him to be merciful and let us go home. And maybe this nightmare will go away. Maybe it'll end up just being a story we can tell when we're older. The skinny guy with the crazy eyes was Kennedy. And he got out of the passenger side door and pulled the seat forward and reached for little Amy. He said, "You first. You can't go together." And the girls both begged him to take them together to see this man. Becky said, "Please let me go first," because she's the older sister and of course she felt responsible for her little sister. but her cries and her pleas were completely ignored.
Meanwhile, Darcy Jenkins, Jerry's wife, had decided that the best thing she could do is to get away as far from Jerry as possible. Now, she decided that rather than wait for him to return with the Impala, she'd make a clean getaway. She went to visit some friends in the next apartment and asked them to help her fix the station wagon's flat. So while they changed the tire, she started throwing everything into the back of the car, getting ready to leave.
Yeah, but then after dark, Darcy had some second thoughts. She decided she'd hang around until he got home so she could look him in the eye and tell him that she was done with him. And this way, maybe she could take the white Impala with her too, which was the better of the cars that they had. So she waited for him, but the hours passed. After she put the babies to bed, she went to see the neighbors who'd fixed her tire, and one of the neighbors stayed up with her that night, drinking coffee and just letting her vent about this no-good husband that she had.
So, before we get into the real horrifying stuff, this would be a good time to just take a quick break for an ad.
Ring in the new year with a new hair care routine with Madison Reed, a company founded by a woman who's on a mission to revolutionize the way that women color their hair. I had been getting my hair colored at the salon, but now I've been using Madison Reed for over a year, and my hair feels soft and healthy. Plus, I think it looks great. What do you think, Dick?
I think it looks fantastic.
Thank you. Madison Reed costs less than $25, and it's delivered to me at my home on my schedule. And it saves me time and money, and I don't have to scrimp on quality either. Remember, it's 2019 now. You don't have to choose between outdated box color or the time and expense of a salon. With Madison Reed, you'll look like you went to the salon, but you'll have me time to do the things that you love. Crafted in Italy by master colorists, Madison Reed is professional hair color you can easily do at home. It's multi-tonal, ammonia-free, and made with ingredients that you can feel good about. You can find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. Madison Reed is honoring True Crime Brewery listeners with 10% off and free shipping on your first color kit with the promo code BREWERY. That's madison-reed.com and use our promo code BREWERY to get 10% off plus free shipping. The code again is BREWERY. Now back to our story.
So sometime during Becky and Amy's abduction, the two men had called each other by their real first names, Jerry and Ronnie, names which would be later recognizable to investigators as two well-known local lowlifes. The two guys drove slowly and aimlessly through town with the two terrified girls trapped in the back seat. They started up Casper Mountain, but Jenkins had to turn around because the car overheated, and he also remembered that the tires were bald. They drove back through town and headed out toward a reservoir, which was about 25 miles away. Kennedy said he had a friend who'd been hit by a car a couple days earlier. The car was identical to Becky's Ford, he told him, and there was a young woman and a little girl in it. The girls, he said, left the scene, and his friend was paralyzed from the neck down. Now his friend was in a trailer, lying low because he was in trouble, and they're going to go out and see him. And they said if it wasn't Becky's car, then they would take the girls home. But if it was them, they would pay for it, and they would be killed.
So they seem like they're actually tormenting the girls.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Beyond all the horrors of abduction, rape, killing, there's a lot of tormenting going on with this whole made-up story about a man. Kind of trying to give them hope and then pulling it out from under them, it's really cruel.
You know, Amy was afraid that she could be hurt by these two creeps.
Or murdered.
And she insisted it couldn't have been them because they just returned from Mexico. So Kennedy says, well, we'll just go out there and see. Then Jerry said he was the one who had slashed their tire. And then he told him he and his friend Jerry were Hell's Angels and they were working for the mafia selling drugs. He told them they've already had a friend take Becky's car from the grocery store lot and smash it up in a ditch. If they weren't the girls who hurt their friend, he said, they'd take them back to that smashed-up car and leave them. They were to keep their mouths shut and say they had a car wreck. Kennedy also told Becky that would explain her now-bleeding nose and swollen eye. because they had been using the two girls as punching bags while they're driving around.
Yeah. Kennedy and Jenkins were drinking from a case of beer, which they were keeping on the seat between them, and they were whispering back and forth. They offered some beer to Becky, who refused it. Becky, of course, was desperate to protect Amy and herself. She asked both Kennedy and Jenkins about their lives and their families, trying to get some, you know, humanizing talk going on here. Jenkins told her he was 39 and not married. Kennedy said he was 29 and not married. Jenkins said that he and Kennedy had been in Vietnam together, and Kennedy had been shot in the head there. "Now he's more animal than man," Jenkins said about Kennedy, kind of as a warning to the girls. He said that he could tell Kennedy anything and Kennedy would do it. So, it's important to point out here that Jenkins was acting like he was in charge, because later on, Jenkins is trying to blame everything on Kennedy.
Right.
As if he was just along. He was just the driver.
I mean, the testimony from Jenkins is that he was just doing what Kennedy told him to do.
Of course.
They neared a little roadside store, and Kennedy pulled out a knife and jumped up in his seat. He started stabbing his seat around the girl's legs. Now, later on, investigators would remember that the punctures in the back seat outlined a girl's body. Then he jabbed the open blade towards Becky's breast and held it close to her heart. "Put your hand on the blade," he ordered. And Amy started screaming and crying uncontrollably and tried to hold her sister's hand. But Kennedy wouldn't let them hold hands. "Becky, I love you so much," Amy cried. Kennedy pushed her hands away from Becky.
Yeah, so Amy asked if she could ask them a question and asked them if they were going to murder her. And Kennedy acted surprised and offended. "Oh, no, honey," he said. "You've been watching too many detective stories on TV." Jenkins turned off onto a lower road to Pathfinder Reservoir, and that would cross the Fremont Canyon Bridge. Kennedy and Jenkins were whispering to each other, and Becky was begging them not to whisper and to tell them what they were saying. Because, you know, they're whispering. Of course you're going to think, what the hell are they talking about, right?
Well, I'm getting worried, right?
Yeah.
Then Amy whispered to Becky, "Becky, if we ever get through this, I'll never be greedy again." So it seems that to Amy, going to the store to buy candy for herself was somehow the cause of their ordeal.
Oh, this just makes me want to cry.
Doesn't it?
This little girl was blaming herself.
And Becky told her, "Amy, it's not your fault at all. Don't worry." Then the car's headlights flashed across the steel of a bridge. Jenkins drove across the bridge slowly and parked on a narrow dirt road at the far end of the bridge.
Yeah, and then he said, "Okay, here we are." And he said that they couldn't both go in at the same time. So both the girls were begging him to let them go together. And Kennedy opened his door, and the dome light showed Becky's swollen, bruised, and bloody face. So this was the first time that Amy really saw how bad Becky's face looked, and she screamed. Kennedy handed Becky his open beer can, and she took a sip from the can. Then Kennedy told Amy to get out of the car and come with him. At this point, Amy stopped crying, and she said, "Okay, Becky." She crawled over her sister Becky's lap and got out of the door that Kennedy was holding, and she told her sister that she loved her. And this was the last time that Becky would ever see Amy, as she was dragged away from that car. Then Kennedy came back, and he was only gone a couple of minutes. He told Becky that her little sister was talking to the man. And then he said, "We're supposed to go up the road a bit and wait for a signal. Then we'll come back down when it's your turn to talk to him." So Jenkins started up the car, and the two men were whispering again. Becky begged them not to whisper. At this point, she's hysterical. They drove about 150 yards up the road and stopped the car. Then Kennedy undressed and climbed into the back seat. He took off Becky's clothes. She pushed him away, trying to block his hands, but he tore off her bra and her panties, and he climbed on top of her. Becky told him she'd never had intercourse before, but he raped her. It was very painful, but he really seemed to enjoy her suffering. The more she seemed in pain, the more he liked it. Jenkins, who'd been sitting in the front smoking a cigarette and watching this rape, got out of the car, climbed in the back, and he also raped Becky. When they were finished with that, Becky asked if she could get dressed. She thanked them for not letting her little sister see the rape. Jenkins got back in the car and started it. Then he backed down the dark dirt road to the spot where they first stopped, where Kennedy had taken Amy out of the car and disappeared for a few minutes. So at this point, Becky's thinking she's going to see her little sister. They raped her, and then maybe her and a little sister will be able to go home. But that isn't what happened at all. The men parked beside an old outhouse. Jenkins shut off the car, and both men got out. Now the night was pitch black. Kennedy and Jenkins stood on either side of the car door as Becky got out of the car, and they each took one of her arms and walked her into the darkness. At the bridge, less than 30 steps from the car, Kennedy spoke. He said, "Okay, we're going to meet Amy right here." Now he said "here" as if this was their cue, because on the word "here," both of the men grabbed her and tried to lift her over the guardrail. It was only 3 feet high, but they couldn't get her over it, so they weren't very strong. But she fought them with all of her strength. They couldn't get her to let go of the rail, so Jenkins began choking her.
Yeah, Jenkins yelled, "Make sure she's going to die. Make sure she'll be dead." At that moment, Becky had to make an impossible choice. She could be strangled and thrown from the bridge unconscious, or she could take her chances at surviving the fall. So she went limp, pretending to be unconscious. Then she let herself fall from the bridge. She was in a free fall, hit a ledge, and then hit the water.
The fall into the river had crippled her, and her legs didn't work. She was 18, but she'd never broken a bone before. But she believed at this point that her legs must have been broken. They just kind of hung from her hips, freezing cold and useless and throbbing with pain. Jenkins and Kennedy hadn't let Becky put her panties and bra back on, just her sweater and her jeans. And when they dumped her off the bridge into the dark, she slammed into a stone ledge. Her body bounced off the wall and plummeted downward. She hit the water. Her lungs burned as water filled her airway, and she clawed in the water with her hands. As the water had pulled her down, and she fought so hard, her pants had slipped off of her. So when she finally made it to the surface of the river, it was still near freezing. She paddled to some granite slabs, dragging her legs out of the water. She felt like screaming, but she was worried that the two men were waiting for her up on the bridge. Stones had cut into her skin as she dragged herself along. She fell into some of the river brush between two boulders, which protected her a little bit from the wind. Then she heard their voices from the top of the canyon, which was more than 100 feet up. They were talking and laughing. Her hips were aching, and she wanted to cry, but she had to keep silent because she was afraid of them hearing her and coming back for her.
Becky fought off sleep and tried to avoid imagining that Amy might be down there in the water. Now, the next day, Carl and Dorothy Strasser rose at dawn. They intended to go fishing that day. They had the day off, and it was going to be a nice day to be out in the fresh air. Although the state highway was faster to their fishing hole, they drove along the more scenic lower road to Pathfinder Reservoir. So as the Strassers drove over the bridge a little after 8 in the morning, they saw a flicker of color that looked out of place, and it was moving. A brown-haired girl lay in the dirt at the end of the bridge, waving her arms. Her red sweater was torn and dirty, and she was nude from the waist down. Carl Strasser braked the car, jumped out, and ran over to the girl. She was pale, dirty, bloody. He could see the cuts where she dragged herself across the gravel from the edge of the canyon. It was near freezing. Dorothy took an old blanket from the trunk and covered Becky. Her face was caked with dried blood. Her left eye was swollen shut. The side of her head was bruised a deep purple. White fat tissue and blood congealed around a long gash on her left hip, and her legs that were covered with blood didn't work at all. "My God, what happened to you?" Carl asked. Becky answered, "I was raped and thrown off the bridge, and my little sister was too. She's down there someplace, and I think she's dead." Becky covered her exposed lower body as best she could with her hands. Carl took off his jacket and tied the arms around Becky's waist to cover her. Now, she couldn't stand, The Strassers lifted her into the back seat of their car, turned the heater up full blast.
Carl ran to the bridge railing and leaned out, looking down. He didn't want to waste time looking for a body that might not be there, but he didn't want to leave Amy down there if she needed help too. But he saw nothing, so he decided to get help for Becky. Back in the car, he drove toward Sloan's store, which is a roadside market about 10 miles down the road. On the way, Becky was crying, and she asked for water. They gave her some hot coffee to drink. She told the Strasslers more of her story about the abduction, the rape, and her fall from the bridge. Down in that dark canyon, she had called out for Amy but got no answer. At the store, Carl ran inside to call the sheriff while Dorothy stayed with Becky in the car. 20 minutes later, the sheriff and an ambulance arrived. The sheriff himself questioned Becky and confirmed that she was one of the two girls who had been reported missing by their mother the night before. On their way to the hospital, Becky became angry. She wanted to stay alive, at least in part, so she could see these men punished. In the hospital, Becky told police how she and Amy had gone to the Thriftway to buy some groceries a little after 9 p.m. It was dark when they left, and they parked near the store's front door. 15 minutes later, they got in Becky's Ford station wagon and backed up a few feet, but Becky noticed that her right rear tire was flat. This made her mad, she said, because she just had it fixed a couple of days earlier. She pulled back into her parking spot beside two guys in a white car who asked if she needed help. So the driver was a fat guy with greasy light-colored hair, wearing a denim jacket. His passenger was a skinny, wild-eyed guy who called himself Kenny, and that was Kennedy. Now they rummaged through Jerry's truck to find a jack, and they jacked up Becky's car a few inches and then stopped. When Becky described her attackers, the policemen were pretty sure they knew who they were. Ronald Kennedy and Jerry Jenkins were small-time crooks who hung out together quite a bit, and every cop in the area knew them and didn't think much of them. So they told Becky they were going to go to another station and see if they could fix her tire real quick. That'd be great, Becky said, and waited for them. So Becky told Amy to run over to the nearby convenience store payphone and call their mom to tell her that they had a flat, but some nice men were going to help them and they'd be right home. The two guys left, but they were back in just 5 minutes, and that was before Amy had returned from the convenience store. Now the men wanted Becky to go with them to the station, but Becky said, "Just a minute, I've got to go get my little sister." Amy had gone into the store after the phone call to her mom and bought herself some candy. Becky hurried her along and they went back to her car together, where Kennedy and Jenkins were waiting. Kennedy then came up beside Becky and stuck a knife against her ribs. And that's when she knew that her and her sister were in big trouble. And that's when they got them into the car. Now this is just so haunting and terrifying to me, because as a teenager, we went out and did things ourselves, me and my girlfriends, me and my sisters, and there were always creepy guys around, trying to get you in the car, trying to talk to you. So this could have happened to me so easily.
Well, you're of the age when it was common for people to be taking rides from strangers.
Yeah.
We don't do that anymore.
But I never did take rides from strangers. Well, but it could have happened. I certainly could have.
You were smart.
I was scared.
and you had big sisters and parents who told you these things.
Well, I'm just saying, that could easily have been me or many of the girls I grew up with.
Sure.
In this situation.
Absolutely.
Which just makes my blood just go cold to think about it.
So when Toni Case was finally allowed to see her daughter, doctors and nurses were still working on her wounds, and police were asking her questions. Becky turned to her mother in tears and said, "Mama, I don't think Amy's coming back." So while Toni comforted Becky, a doctor removed a contact lens that had become trapped in her swollen eye. So investigators arranged for a photo lineup for Becky. She easily picked out Kennedy and Jenkins. Later that morning, detectives staked out Kennedy's house. This was his mother's house where Kennedy was living at the time. Then they heard on the police radio that both Kennedy and Jenkins had been spotted together in Kennedy's old green pickup on the nearby highway. They were about to return to the house when an investigator saw Kennedy's truck going down the street right past them. But Kennedy was alone, so if Jenkins had been with him, he'd apparently gotten out of the truck. Now, after a few blocks, Kennedy stopped at a stoplight on a main street. A few pedestrians crossed in front of his truck. Investigator Dave Duvala leapt from his car and ran to the center of the main street to Kennedy's open window. He drew his handgun as he was running. Then he quickly opened the driver's side door and dragged Kennedy out onto the road, with the car's engine still running. Duvala arrested Ronald Kennedy, who was taken to the police department only 30 paces away from where he was cuffed.
Yeah, so he's right there by the courthouse and the police station.
It was handy.
But this is some police work, huh? This is kind of Starsky and Hutchish. Jumping out of the car, pulling the gun,
yeah.
Getting the door open.
This is big stuff.
And this policeman would become very close to Becky over the years. He actually walked her down the aisle at her wedding.
Yeah, they became friends.
Yes. Now, Jerry Jenkins was spotted on foot, headed to a neighborhood liquor store, one that he'd actually robbed a few years before with Ron Kennedy. Two cops pulled up in a cruiser beside him and told him he was under arrest. And Jenkins acted surprised. They read him his rights and cuffed him, telling him that he was a suspect in a rape and murder. There was a pocket knife in Jenkins' pants pocket, the same knife Kennedy had used to abduct and terrorize Becky and Amy that night before. Now that afternoon, Jerry Jenkins was brought into the interrogation room in handcuffs. He kept his head down. He'd been in police custody for less than an hour, kept in a holding cell at the end of the hall. And throughout his interrogation, he put most of the blame on Kennedy. And he refused to answer if he had raped Becky. Now, at age 29, Jenkins already knew the criminal justice system very well. He ran away from home 4 times when he was 15, always returned to his parents until the last time when he was turned over to juvenile probation officers. His father, Edgar Jenkins, was a truck driver who was often away from home. The Jenkins family was a big mess. Getting drunk and fighting were just commonplace. The father beat the mother and the kids, and they moved around frequently. The kids got into drugs and crime when they were quite young. Now, while other kids in the neighborhood were going to the soda shop together or to the movies, Jenkins fell in with the local troublemakers, stealing cars and staying drunk most of the time. So Jenkins was arrested 9 times before he even turned 18. Some of the offenses, public drunkenness, careless driving, vagrancy, and even a hit and run. He served 2 sentences at the Wyoming Boys School, a reformatory for juvenile offenders, and at 18, he said he wanted to join the Army, so they let him out. He passed the test, but as soon as he was out, he went AWOL before he was even inducted into the Army.
One summer night in 1968, Jerry Jenkins and another man got drunk, and they somehow got a 19-year-old woman into their car, supposedly to get a soda at a local diner. But instead, they drove her to a deserted road, parked beside a deep irrigation canal, and raped her. They later dumped her, alive, behind an apartment building in town, and they threatened to kill her if she told the cops what had happened. But she did tell the cops, and Jenkins and this other guy were arrested. The other man's trial was first, and he was convicted of first-degree rape. But before Jenkins' trial could start, the raped woman decided she had suffered enough throughout the cross-examination in the first guy's trial, so she refused to testify further, and Jerry Jenkins walked. So Jenkins described how he and Kennedy had driven back to town, dumped Becky's purse and some other evidence off of another bridge, and then he dropped Kennedy at his house. Jenkins arrived home around 2 in the morning. Now, his wife wasn't home at the time, but when she did arrive, they fought until after dawn. The next morning, groggy and still a little drunk, because he had inhaled an ocean of beer the day before.
Cases.
Jenkins had another beer, a little hair of the dog. He told police that he'd contemplated surrendering, but while driving around, he saw Kennedy. Over coffee at a truck stop on the edge of town, he confessed to feeling guilty and wanted to spill his guts to police. Then he said that he met Kennedy for coffee, and Kennedy threatened his life if he told anyone what they had done.
Yeah, so they didn't really believe that he had said that to Kennedy. He's just trying to look like he was the innocent one.
It's all bullshit.
Yeah. So when the case finally went to trial, Becky testified against both men. She had to point them out in the courtroom, as Kennedy actually taunted her by smiling while sliding his finger across his throat. They were both convicted of first-degree murder, rape, and assault and battery. They were sentenced to death, but their sentences were reduced to life in prison in 1977 when the Wyoming Supreme Court overturned the state's death penalty. So every time the two would come up for parole, Becky had to relive that horrible night. Kennedy had been appealing for a retrial, an effort that friends say was very troubling and frightening for Becky. So Becky launched a statewide petition opposing parole for the two men, and she gathered hundreds of signatures. Her sisters, who were still alive, Kelly Burridge and Blythe Johnson, were among those going door-to-door getting the signatures with her. So Becky had a fairly successful life for a while. She sold advertising for a Casper radio station as she got older, and she was a friendly, high-functioning woman. She loved to play jokes, and she never forgot anyone's birthday. She also had a daughter, who she adored.
Yeah, but beneath her friendly smile, she was plagued with guilt about Amy's death. She had survived, and Amy had not. And she carried Amy's picture in her wallet for her entire life.
So that night and what happened never left her.
No, I mean, this poor woman had just major PTSD.
Yeah, you're right. And I don't know if she got as much therapy as she probably should have.
I don't know.
But I mean, just living through something like that, it kind of destroyed her, really. It really kind of destroyed who she was. She was never the same, but she really tried. It seems like she put in such an effort to try and get along in life.
She did. But by 1992, almost 20 years after the murder and rape, she was just plunging deeper and deeper into despair. She was divorced, in debt, alcoholic, and filled with fear that Kennedy and Jenkins might actually succeed in an appeal to get a new trial and go free.
Well, that has to be a real fear. That has to be terrifying.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if they are going up before the parole board and doing appeals, I'd be terrified. So that July in 1992, with her boyfriend and her two-year-old daughter, Becky took a drive to the site of Amy's murder. And as she stood on the bridge, her boyfriend stepped away briefly to put their child in the car. And at that moment, he heard a crash. And Becky was gone. Becky's death came just days before the announcement that Kennedy and Jenkins had been denied a new trial. She was raped and murdered 19 years ago. But she died Friday, said Sheriff Davola, who had arrested the two men the day that Becky had crawled out of the canyon and who had been part of Becky's life.
He had. Now, on the day she died, Becky was 37, and she ignored her boyfriend's pleading and driven along the winding hilly country roads to the Fremont Canyon Bridge. Sky was clear, and the sun was setting. Standing perilously above the narrow gorge, Becky plunged to her death. Becky's boyfriend and her two-year-old daughter from her failed marriage were with her the night she died. The boyfriend said Becky wouldn't tell him why she wanted to return to the bridge. She hadn't been there in all the years. This is the first time she'd worked up the courage or whatever to go there.
And maybe just being there was too much for her.
Yeah, or maybe she was planning to kill herself.
Well, sure, that's possible too.
So, and the boyfriend said she's just said she had to go there, and the more I told her not to go there, the faster she went. When she was hitting 70 miles an hour, that's when I shut up.
Yeah, so Becky pulled the car to the far side of the bridge, and she, her boyfriend, and her two-year-old daughter walked beside the waist-high railing. Becky pointed out where the men had raped her, where they'd thrown her over, where she'd hit the protruding rock ledge, and where she'd spent the night, shivering and terrified, thinking they might come back for her, thinking that her little sister was dead below her. She was dangling her legs through the railing and resting her arms on top of it, and she was crying as she told her boyfriend how she had begged the men, "Please don't hurt or rape Amy." She told her boyfriend she loved him and ran her hands through his hair. And he told her that the baby shouldn't see her cry, and that's when he was taking the baby back to the car. And that's when he heard the crash of Becky's body hitting the water. He ran back to the bridge with the daughter in his arms, and the baby was crying and screaming, and he was crying and screaming. It was just a horrible, horrible day. Police, who ruled out foul play, pulled Becky's body out of the water just about an hour later, and this was very near where they had found Amy's body, at the bottom of the shallow water there. Becky had landed near the bank in about 3 feet of water, and like her sister, 19 years before, she had a broken neck and massive head injuries. So none of us can ever know exactly what went through Becky's mind in the last few moments of her life, or what events were going on in the weeks and hours leading up to her death. But it's very haunting just to think about what she was dealing with. She spent that long night at the bottom of the canyon. And one thing that we read in the book The Darkest Night by Ron Francel, which is a book about this case, was that there was kind of a false dawn that night that would have led her to believe it was morning, that it was becoming morning and it would be light soon, when actually she was still hours away from daylight.
Yeah, she was just trying to survive the night, and it started getting light and she was thinking dawn was coming, but it was just a trick of the light, and dawn was still a few hours away. The other thing that's amazing to me is this woman had a fractured pelvis. So from the waist down, her legs were pretty much useless.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, she climbed 100 feet or so out of that canyon onto the road. And I guess climb isn't the way to put it very accurately. She pulled herself out.
Well, it is amazing, because other people have said they tried to make that climb in perfectly good health, and it's tough.
Right, with 4 good extremities.
Right. Now, another thing about her boyfriend's story of when Becky killed herself is that the week before, she bought Ode to Billy Joe, which is a movie about a boy who couldn't cope with memories of being molested and jumped off Mississippi's Tallahatchie Bridge. And he said that Becky watched this 4 times that week and cried each time. And she just said that she had to see it because it reminded her, and she liked to cry. Her friends and family would say that Becky lived in fear of her abductors. She was just terrified that they would escape or be paroled and return to kill her. So although she went for years without drinking, she did recently start drinking again shortly before her death. And the night she died, she and her boyfriend shared 2 pitchers of beer. So her family thinks about this. They come up with what they think happened that night. And her mother thought that alcohol gave Becky a false sense of courage to face her fears. And then once she got there, she just couldn't cope with being there. Maybe she thought that she would go there and she could get past all the feelings she had, her PTSD, by facing it head on. Becky's stepfather, Jack Case, likes to think that she just lost her balance, that she didn't want to die, but she slipped.
Yeah, and her former husband said maybe she jumped off in an impulsive act.
But it almost seems like this was planned to me.
Yeah, no, yeah. I think it was.
I think that she had this in mind when she went there.
Yeah, her ex-husband also said that Becky always thought that she should have died and not her sister. And he thought that she was at the point where she just gave up. And the reason she went back to the bridge was because of her sister, to be with Amy.
And our research does show a strong link between PTSD and suicide. A study in the journal Depression and Anxiety found that of those who reported a past traumatic event, 28% have attempted suicide. And a study published in the journal Social Psychiatry and Psychiatric Epidemiology found that of those with chronic PTSD, more than half had some suicidal thoughts, and nearly 10% had made attempts after the trauma. So it's very possible that Becky jumped off that bridge on purpose. She had so much to deal with.
She did. Years earlier, Becky had been referred to a psychiatrist who was going to help her deal with her issues. This psychiatrist told her that she was blocking out many of her memories of the crime, and he thought she would do better if she could remember everything that had happened. So he scheduled a session in a private office at the hospital. Now, she later told friends that the psychiatrist made her breathe a gaseous truth serum that would help unlock memories she had pushed beyond her conscious grasp. The doctor told her to let him know when she started feeling the slightest bit unusual, but because she was an addict and because the gas's first soothing effects gave her a kind of euphoria, she didn't say anything. And she woke up 3 days later, couldn't remember anything. But she did have a vague memory of some sexual encounter while she was in a dream state, half awake. When she told her friends, most of them passed it off as a drug-induced hallucination. And when she told her group therapists about it, they asked the psychiatrist to answer any questions she might have in front of her fellow addicts and other staff. Becky was humiliated and backed down. It not only disgraced her, but she felt she was risking having the entire medical community turning against her.
Well, plus you have to remember, she's already been a victim of sexual assault, so this is very difficult for her. But what's really interesting to me is that this psychiatrist did ultimately face at least 3 lawsuits by former patients who said that he did have improper sex with them. They were all settled out of court between 1990 and 1992, each for 6-figure amounts. So it sounds like there's something to that.
Certainly does.
This psychiatrist also lost his Idaho medical license, and then he fled to Texas. In 1993, about a year after Becky's death, he was extradited back to Wyoming to face 15 sexual assault charges in criminal court. And in a plea bargain, he pleaded no contest to 2 second-degree rape charges in exchange for only 5 years probation. And during that time, he couldn't treat any female patients. But that means he's still treating male patients.
Yeah.
How outrageous is that?
Very.
And you know how much his fine was?
Chicken feed.
$50.
Yeah.
So had Becky been one of his unknown victims? Had she been raped once by her 2 killers? And then again in the safety of a clinic by a doctor she trusted to help her? And I call them her killers because they really did kill her. It took 19 years, but they killed her.
They did.
It's impossible to know if she was a victim, but it certainly seems like she could have been. She had discussed a lawsuit with a lawyer, but she died before it was prepared. And she also fit the profile of that doctor's typical victims. Attractive, troubled, with long dark hair. And the assault that she described sounded like some of his known victims' accounts of this doctor's assaults. Soon after his conviction on sex charges, the psychiatrist left his prison counseling job and is no longer working as a psychiatrist. But imagine what Becky had been through, and then if her psychiatrist raped her too? I just can't imagine the trauma. How could you trust anyone again, really?
I don't see how you could. And this woman has been through so much in her life. And then to have this happen by someone she trusted, who is supposed to help her get better.
I know, right?
That's just destroying.
It's horrible. So after her death, which was in 1992, her ex-husband took custody of their toddler, who was 2, and he moved out of Wyoming. Jerry Jenkins died in 1998, leaving Ronald Kennedy as the only person alive who knew what happened that night in 1973.
And he is still on death row.
But isn't he blaming it all on the one who died, on Jenkins?
Well, sure. But that's how you do it. You're in a partnership until you get caught, and then you point the finger at the other person.
Is there any chance he'll get out?
I don't think so.
No, he must be quite old by now. This happened in 73.
So it's 45 years ago.
So if he was 30, he's in his 70s.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's not going to get out. And even if he did, there are several references in that book we read about the townspeople that would take care of things. If he ever did get out on parole, he probably wouldn't last very long.
I'll put a link to the book on our show notes because it was a really good book that went over the whole case.
Very well written, interesting book.
But haunting, I must say.
It was.
Lost some sleep with that.
That was a tough story.
Sure was. The music for True Crime Brewery is written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you want more TCB, you can go to our website, tigrabber.com, and join Team Tigrabber for access to members-only episodes. Along with this exclusive access to our large bank of members-only episodes, you'll receive a gift from us, as well as our undying admiration. You can also go to Patreon and become a patron of True Crime Brewery for the same benefits. Now, in November, we covered the murders at White House Farm, and other members-only episodes include the case of child killer Diane Downs, our O.J. Simpson series, the case of Robert Fisher, just a whole bunch of them. Now, some other ways for you to show your support for True Crime Brewery are to follow us on Twitter at TyGrabberPods, on Instagram, TyGrabberPodcasts, and on Facebook. On Facebook, you can join our True Crime Brewery fan discussions group and get into some conversations about past cases and other crime topics. If you enjoy the show, please take a minute to give us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen, because that helps us a lot and it helps new listeners find us. So let's move forward with feedback now. Remember, you can send feedback and case suggestions to us in an email to truecrimebrewery@tygrabber.com, or just tell us in your own voice by leaving a voicemail on the Leave a Voicemail link on the front page of our website, tygrabber.com.
Okay, on to the feedback. First, we'll do some voicemails. I have three of them.
Okay, what you got?
And the first one's from Jenny.
Hi, Jill. Hi, Dick. My name is Jenny. I am calling you from London. As you can tell from my accent, I'm American. I live over here now. I just finished listening to your What Happened to Heidi episode, and the minute that I heard she was acting as a confidential informant, I knew I had to call you and tell you about my friend Rachel Hoffman, who in 2008, when she was only 23 years old, she was murdered, shot to death while acting as a confidential informant in a botched drug sting in Tallahassee, Florida. So what happened is she was facing a little bit of jail time for possession of marijuana and 4 ecstasy tablets. The Tallahassee Police Department pressured her to act as a confidential informant and said, "We'll think about reducing your sentence if you do this for us." So they set up this drug buy, and she was to act as the buyer. So Rachel was given $13,000 in cash, and she was told to buy 1,500 ecstasy pills, 2 ounces of cocaine, and 2 handguns. Rachel had no experience buying cocaine, buying handguns, and if you ask me, this is a very far cry from having a few ounces of pot and 4 ecstasy pills, from that to coke and guns, but I digress. She also had never had any contact with the 2 men who she was supposed to be meeting to make this buy. So there were 2 officers assigned to supervise this drug sting. And it was later, after an investigation, they were deemed insufficient manpower to protect her and also apprehend the suspects. So while she was at the buy, with the policeman monitoring, the 2 suspects, changed the location of the buy. She was told not to follow them to the new location, but, and this is a quote from her Wikipedia page, if anyone wants to look it up, the murder of Rachel Hoffman, "technical issues prevented her from actually receiving the instructions," end quote. So the police officers lost track of her because she agreed to go to this new location. She got in the car with the suspects and they shot her to death with the gun that she was instructed to buy. Her family sued the Tallahassee Police Department for wrongful death. And if there's anything good that came out of this terrible situation, it was that we now have something called Rachel's Law, which requires law enforcement agencies to provide special training for officers who recruit confidential informants. Again, I want to reiterate, she was only 23 years old. She never had any experience buying handguns or cocaine. She was set up to meet with complete strangers. And it's just a tragic situation all around, and I'm sure this happens much more than we hear about. Thank you very much, and I love your show. Bye.
Wow.
Yeah, this is exactly what we were talking about with Heidi, that you kind of entrap a young kid, or a relatively young kid, who's been picked up for a fairly minor drug offense, and get them to be a confidential informant. And a lot of times there's no specific training or anything that's done.
But this one's outrageous.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
This is just...
Oh my God.
Almost over the top.
Almost over the top. This is so irresponsible and awful. The poor young woman. Well, that is just a great suggestion for you to send to us, Jenny. I am amazed by that story, and I definitely want to find out more about it. And I think you're right. I think it does happen more often than we hear of.
Oh, it does. We hear the tip of the iceberg about the real disasters that happen.
Sure.
I bet there's a bunch of near disasters or near misses.
Sure. But so. This one is just a complete tragedy. And so irresponsible by the police. It's just disgusting.
It is. It's an interesting case. And I think we'll look into that and see about doing it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Hey, thank you, Jenny.
All right.
Then we have Alan.
Hey, Jill and Dick. I'm from Ferndale, Washington. I've had a lot of my neighbors down south from Bellingham call. And I'm an electrician up here, and I have everybody on the job sites listening to True Crime Brewery. And we all thought you should do a show on Kim Proctor from Victoria, B.C. That case was something else, and thank you.
All right, Alan, right to the point.
Yeah, so we're going to get right to the point, and just very quickly. One night around dinner time, Cruz, K-R-U-S-E, Wellwood, sent an instant message to Kim Proctor. Hey, I thought you had babysitting. Did you finish early? So he was this gawky 16-year-old, scraggly hair, living in a bungalow with his mother on Happy Valley Road in the town of Langford, British Columbia. On this evening, as on so many others, Cruz was hanging out with his best friend Cameron Moffat. But, like many kids his age, Cruz spent as much time with friends online as he did in person. So when he wasn't texting, he was playing World of Warcraft or chatting over the Microsoft network with friends. So when Cruz IM'd Kim to see if she was done babysitting, no response came. But he didn't expect one because the instant message was a cover.
Oh.
Cruz knew Kim had never made it to her job.
Oh.
She was right there in his house with him and Cam, bound, beaten, raped, and by the next morning stuffed into his freezer, dead.
Holy shit.
Yes.
Okay, so you've got some more on that, so you want to consider covering that case?
I definitely do.
All right, well, thanks, Alan. Good suggestion.
Yeah, and then our last one is from Yannick, who's also, well, you'll play it. You'll hear he's offering his assistance.
All right, let's hear it.
Hello, Jill and Dick. This is Yannick, one of your attorney friend listeners, located in Columbia, South Carolina. I enjoy your podcast, in particular the depth and the detailed medical and legal analysis that you provide with each case. I also have a case suggestion for you, which is the case of Wesley Allen Dodd. He was a sex offender and serial killer in the Pacific Northwest in the 1980s and 90s. I think it would be an interesting podcast for you to undertake for several reasons. First, the system failed when he wasn't prosecuted or arrested after multiple inappropriate contacts with children. Also, his arrest and capture is an interesting story in itself. Finally, he's one of the few criminals sentenced to death that actually took steps to move his execution date forward. I believe he was the last person hanged in the state of Washington. Once again, I really enjoy your podcast. Can't wait for the next episode to come out. Keep up the good work. And if you have any legal questions, I may be able to assist. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks, Janik. I think that's awesome that we have someone who wants to assist us with our legal questions, because you know we have them.
Oh, we do. And yeah. I think Yannick sounds like a good resource.
Absolutely. I love that.
Plus, he's from one of my favorite cities.
Yeah.
Go Cox. Now, I'm not going to say too much about Wesley Allen Dodd, other than that he was a bad apple almost from the start, beginning his crime spree or sprees around age 12 or 13. As Yannick said, he had been arrested or detained numerous times for sexual misbehaviors, and never did he get convicted of anything. The system really failed.
Well, and pedophilia, it sounds like.
Yes. And then when he finally was caught and sentenced, he was to be executed. He was sentenced to death, and he actually pushed for it, said, do it. He was hanged on January 5th, 1993. It was the first legal hanging in the United States since 1965, and it's the last hanging in the state of Washington.
Am I the only one that's kind of shocked that someone was hanged in 1993? That's not that long ago.
No.
And when we think of hanging, we think of kind of medieval or at least Old West justice. So that alone is fascinating to me.
Yeah, the little bit I read about Wesley Dodd was very interesting. So I think that that's someone we're going to look at to do a case.
Okay.
Okay, those are the voicemails. We've got two emails, one of which has two suggestions. These are all case suggestions. So the first one's for you. It's from Sandy.
Okay, Sandy writes, "Hi, Jill and Dick. I'm a new listener here, and I am now just listening to the Mainline murder. I'm very familiar with this story growing up in Montgomery County. Stephanie's brother Ira worked at a steakhouse my family frequented back when the murder happened and was very well liked. It was so sad to see how much Ira changed after his sister was killed, just not as lively." Just reading that sentence, I'd like to add, that's one thing we've definitely learned from doing this podcast, is one person might be killed, but it destroys the lives of many people.
Yeah.
It's a ripple effect.
Family.
Yeah.
It certainly is.
Totally. So Sandy goes on, "I was wondering if you ever heard about the murders of Lisa Marie Mandurak and her 19-month-old daughter, Devon. This happened in 1995 in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, which is also in Montgomery County. Just a horrible story of two lives cut way too short." And then she wished us a wonderful holiday season and says, "Cheers." Thanks, Sandy. Happy holidays to you. So Caleb Fairley is an American murderer from Gulf Mills, Pennsylvania. And in 1995, Fairley murdered Lisa Marie Mandurak, who was 29, and her 19-month-old daughter, Devon, when the two visited the Collegeville, Pennsylvania children's clothing store where he worked. On September 10th, 1995, Fairley was working alone at Your Kids and Mine, the Collegeville children's clothing store owned by his parents. Now, just before closing time, Lisa Marie and her daughter entered the store. When Fairley realized that they were the only customers present, he locked the doors to the store. He then attempted to sexually assault Lisa Marie, and when she resisted him, he became enraged and strangled her to death. He also strangled the baby. And after the murder, he sexually assaulted Lisa Marie's body, then went to an Electric Hellfire Club concert that he'd been planning to attend that night. So this is really horrific, to think you could go into a store with your baby. I mean, who would even think that that's a dangerous thing to do, right?
I know. And you're in a good part of town, right?
Yeah, right.
Not like you're...
You're going to buy clothes for your baby.
Yep.
Wow. Horrific.
Certainly is.
So well, thank you for that suggestion, Sandy. We'll definitely look more into that. Although that's one of those ones that's going to give me nightmares.
Then we have an email from Barbara from North Carolina. And she's got a couple case suggestions.
Okay.
And I didn't put any real discussion on them because she described them pretty nicely.
Great. Thanks, Barbara.
So you want to take this?
Sure. So the first one is Michelle Young was found beaten to death in her Raleigh, North Carolina home on November 3rd, 2006. Michelle was 5 months pregnant at the time. She also had a 2.5-year-old daughter who was left unharmed in the home. After his first trial ended in a hung jury, Michelle's husband, Jason, was convicted in 2012 and is currently serving life without parole for this crime. Barbara says that Michelle was her co-worker and someone she liked and respected, so she's followed this case closely. "I'm aware that opinions on Jason's guilt vary based on who you talk to. I'd love to hear you cover it and hear what you think." So she also gives you a beer suggestion from Raleigh. Lone Rider beer?
Lone Rider. This is their IPA called Hoppy Caye. We just heard that on a couple movies, didn't we?
Well, Die Hard. Yippee-ki-yay, right. Motherfucker. Not right. Hoppy Caye. Yes, well, those are Christmas movies, especially part one and two.
That's
in
right.
Our Christmas movie list.
But that's a pretty good beer. So let's think about that, not just because of the beer.
Gosh, you know, that North Carolina, though, I bet the most murders we've covered have been there.
Oh, I think Florida is the number one.
Florida,
North
yeah.
North Carolina is right up there.
Yeah, it's that southeastern United States you want to watch out for. Now, the next one is Nancy Cooper, who we've already done a podcast on this case. So is there additional information in here? I know there are widely varying opinions on Brad's guilt.
Right.
Well, she says that Nancy was strangled in a drainage ditch. Her husband, Brad, was arrested for the murder in 2008 and convicted in 2011. But in 2013, he was granted a new trial. In 2014, he agreed to plead guilty to second-degree murder in exchange for a sentence of 12 to 15 years. And there are a large group of supporters who think that Brad is innocent.
Yeah, we discussed that, didn't we?
We did, yep. But another interesting thing is that she suggests another North Carolina brewery in Cary, North Carolina, which is Bond Brothers Beer.
Mm-hmm. And it's one of your favorite beers that she's recommended.
Flavor Pattern Sour Ale, which I have not had.
No, we'll look for that, too.
Get me some of that.
Okay, even though we've done this case.
Well, we can also do the beer because there are plenty of murders in North Carolina to go around, right?
There certainly are. We shouldn't say it that way.
No.
There's a good number of murders.
Why is that? Do we know?
No, I don't know. I suppose we could look at any state virtually and find a good number of murders that would be good episodes to do.
Well, and it could be that these are just famous murders or interesting murders or unusual murders, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've done the staircase.
Which is a fascinating case.
We've done the poor little girl from Australia who was killed.
Zara Baker.
The McDonald case.
Right. And then we've got the Eastburn murders coming
next
up,
week
too.
Is Eastburn.
Yeah. So there are a lot of murders there. I'm sorry if you live there, but be careful, please. So that wraps it up for the day. This is New Year's Day, so I think that it's time to sign off and let people celebrate the new year coming in.
For those of you who are awake, we went to bed.
Well, we made it to 10:30, 10:45, but then the dogs insisted we had to go to bed. They were tired. But we did have a sip of champagne and welcomed in the new year just a little bit early.
So see you next week, guys.
All right. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time at The Quiet End.
Bye.
Bye-bye.